Connect the dots with Allison Rose Levy, Saturdays at noon, Eastern, on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're here with you every Saturday at noon Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a Huffington Post blogger and health screen and environmental journalist for going on three decades. We also try to connect the dots between personal health, societal health, the environment, and social activism, because for years I sort of preached and offered health advice and ways to eat healthy and be healthy, but more and more we've seen that unless we make sure we have a healthy world, that isn't going to be so easy. Rising rates of illness in the general population, especially in young people, with more cancer, the obesity epidemic, spectrum disorders, and everything else, many of the causes and contributing factors are in fact environmental. And it's one thing to give personal health advice, and it's a great thing to follow it, which I have advocated and offered and done myself for 25 years. But it's another thing to sort of stand in gale force winds and protect that we can, you know, individually elect to be healthy through personal choice when societal choices affect the things that we rely on for health, such as healthy water, healthy food, and healthy air. And on Connect the Dots, we also talk about personal and cultural attitudes that breed both individual and widespread social problems, which will be part of our theme today. But first, I want to go to our activist alert of today. And unlike most weeks, as frequent return listeners will know, I have a website, healthjournalistblog.com, where I regularly feature blogs as well as actions, specific actions that you can take to protect our health and environment. This week I didn't do it because I'm taking a little mini break from blogging while I complete my book. But we do have a wonderful action for you today. If you will go, please, to CatskillMountainKeeper.org. That's CatskillMountainKeeper, Mountainkeeper. And this is a wonderful organization, one of many organizations in the grassroots groups across America and now up into the Northeast that are protecting the water supply upon which we rely for our food and our health and our drinking water, which makes up 65% of our body. From a new practice, relatively recent over the last 10 years, called hydraulic fracturing, fracking. You may have heard of it through the film Gasland. Today, there's a very important action going on because the water of 15 million people is about to very quickly become polluted by a tri-state decision to drill in the Delaware River Basin. And today's action from Mount Catskill Mountain Keeper, and again, that's at CatskillMountainKeeper.org, is a letter to the representative on the DRBC from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers requesting that they do environmental studies before they impact the water and a sensitive ecosystem that affects the drinking water of 15 million people in major cities like New York and Philadelphia. So I strongly urge that on you today. And I also want to mention the book Raising Elijah by Sandra Steingraber, who has been an outspoken critic of this unhealthy practice. She is a mom, an ecologist, and a poet. It's a beautiful book that really delves into exactly the kinds of things we discuss here on Connect the Dots, which is how our social choices, you know, can create deep, deep, ongoing, you know, impossible to really get the full magnitude of how serious these can be, environmental shifts and attendant health problems. And she was actually testifying this week before the New York State Assembly in Albany, New York, and basically said, if we do this, we're all going to die. You know, I don't even think that's very extreme. There's these things have not been studied. They use highly toxic chemicals. So, you know, on the one side you hear, well, there's no proof. And at a panel at which she appeared this week along with several other scientists and notable speakers, it was said, well, if you don't do the studies, then you say there's no proof. So that's what we're doing in our action today. We are asking for the studies to be done. So on CatskillMountainkeeper.org, writing to the Brigadier General, who is with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, to say, please do the environmental study in the basin of the Delaware River Valley before drilling there with toxic chemicals that could affect the water supplies of so many people. So, now shifting gears today to our guest on today's show, who I'm so thrilled to have with us, and her name is Lila Levinson. She's written a wonderful new book called Gated Grief. The daughter of a GI concentration camp liberator discovers a legacy of trauma. As many of our listeners know, I have blogged on the Huffington Post since about 2007, and I recently saw this wonderful blog that Lila had written and posted it on my Facebook site. And for those who would like to participate in the Facebook conversation with me, please go to Facebook and like Connecting the Dots for Health, where we have these wonderful sharings and conversations. And there was a whole thread with so many people just absolutely fascinated by this issue. And so we'll bring Lila in shortly. The essence of it is that, you know, here we have a war going on nowadays with a lot of repercussions in terms of combat stress and other things. And, you know, we don't think, we don't really understand how long-lived some of these tragic stressors and traumatic incidents that soldiers have in wartime are, and how they even affect the next generation. It is very well documented, for example, that the descendants of people who were in concentration camps and who are, you know, Holocaust survivor descendants have a whole wide range of psychological and physiological ongoing health impacts down many generations. But as Lila Levinson points out in Gated Grief, it's not only those who participated directly as victims, it's even those who bore witness in the U.S. Army and actually were the first to see the horror when the soldiers came in and liberated the camps. So I want to welcome you to Connect the Dots, Lila. It's lovely to have you here with us today.
Hi, Allison. I'm just really delighted to participate in your program.
This is such a an amazing topic, and I love your title, too, because Gated Grief, there's a beautiful image on the cover of your book, which I hope readers will see when they get the book, which really, you know, shows what the sort of the what was locked inside and what was going on inside these camps was gated. And so people really outside didn't know or were in denial or had no way to know really what was going on there. And so the moment when the, you know, this, when this was became known and revealed to outside observers directly, except, you know, then by report or whatever, was when these soldiers came in to liberate and they for the first time saw the inhumanity and horror that had occurred within. And then, as your book so movingly points out, they themselves had to, in effect, close the gate on their own grief and horror because not talking about, not sharing, not knowing how to process, not knowing how to hold these terribly traumatizing memories and experiences. And, of course, at the time, there was very little treatment or discussion of any of this, very little knowledge about it. It's only really recently in the last decade or so that we really have better understanding of how to treat trauma. And even so, there's a lot less treatment and there are many different theories of treatment. So not even today, people are certainly not, everyone isn't getting all the treatment that might be necessary. But at that time, it wasn't even a question. So, you know, please share with our listeners, Lila, how you came to explore this topic.
Well, I think like so many other children of World War II veterans, I grew up knowing that my dad had participated in the war. He had been a doctor for the Army in the European theater. And like so many of the other veterans, he rarely ever spoke about it at all. I knew he had been part of D-Day right behind the first wave of troops on Utah Beach. I think he mentioned the Battle of the Bulge every now and then. But that was the extent of it, and I just never thought about it at all. And only when he died in 1988, I discovered his army trunk down in the basement of his medical office. And inside was a shoebox that was just, when I opened it, the photographs just poured out. And my father was a bit of a shutterbug. He always loved to take pictures on vacation. And he was also a very meticulous, methodical man. So on the backs of each of these photographs was the place and date he had taken it. And many of the photographs, though interesting as a documentation of his war, didn't surprise me very much. But at the very bottom of the box were these images that I went into shock when I saw them. They showed endless skeletal bodies. And the backs of the photographs said Nordhausen Concentration Camp, April 12, 1945. And I refused to even believe that my father had taken those and couldn't understand why they were in that box. But a few days later, one of his sisters told me, when I brought up the topic, she said, yes, your dad's division liberated that camp. And because he was a doctor, he stayed to treat survivors. Well, but after a few weeks, he had a mental breakdown.
Oh, my goodness.
And that term, mental breakdown, in connection to my father, was really almost more information than I could incorporate. Because he hated therapists, he hated psychologists, he had no patience for them. And I really just kind of locked it all away myself for over a dozen years before I was ready to deal with it. And then I had another episode of depression. I'd always been very vulnerable to depression in my own life, and nightmares and some major levels of anxiety. And when my second child was born, that came up again. And I realized, you know what? I need to deal with this. Somehow, intuitively, I knew that those photographs were a clue. So
now, let me ask you something. What you're describing in terms of second-generation aftermath, the depression that you experienced, have you encountered others in, you know, who are, you know, like yourself, second-generation, or is there any kind of a psychological literature on this that, you know, you encountered through exploring?
Yeah, what you're getting at is what really, really amazes me, because not only could I find no literature on how the liberating troops were affected psychologically, emotionally, I couldn't find any literature at all on the trauma of World War II veterans. It is like, because we have called them the greatest generation, and because we see that war as having been a good war, as Studs Terkel called it, somehow we like to think then that that makes those participants immune to the horror, that they were resilient and just bounced back afterwards. So there certainly wasn't any literature at all on that, yet alone on how my generation, the baby boomers, were shaped by our father's war. So it's like this vast subject has just gone ignored. And yet I traveled around the country meeting over 80 other men and women who liberated camps, and meeting many more who were in the war but didn't see the camps. All of them, even the ones who didn't see the camps, all of them are still in the grips of the trauma. 66
well, that's
years
not
later.
Surprising, because it it hasn't been treated. You know, when we look at our personal lives or history for that matter, you know, that which you don't accept and process and address and deal with in some way, come to terms with, will be repeated again almost as if it's a second opportunity to heal, you know, a particular wound. And so it will repeat in order to try to heal that thing. It will call it. It will bring it back to our attention.
That we don't realize. Nightmares are our friends. Nightmares bring to us messages of what our work is still to be done. And
right, but on a sociological level also, Lila, it's mm-hmm. like the whole nation, you know, we find ourselves at war. We hear a lot of harshness in public life spoken about, a lot of punitive and cruel, vicious kinds of attitudes. And I often wonder, where does this come from? We, you know, as a nation would repeat a pattern and go to war or experience a problem when we haven't coped with some of these aftermaths. So it's going on concurrently, individual by individual, and then it's going, you know, as a national cultural pattern.
As Jung says, you know, all of our psyches are tied in to, mm-hmm. to the core. You know, everybody's psyche expresses part of the universal archetype.
Mm-hmm.
It's subconscious. Mm-hmm. Right, so each individual person's nightmare is part of the society's nightmare. And
very brilliantly said. That's really, really true. And sometimes too, in just the way, so it's like, you know, the picture I get when you say that, Lila, it's as if your dad, you know, it's as if, well, the people who lived through the experience had the big nightmare, right? And then the people who first came to witness it, like your father and my father also was in that group, you know, they were the ones who had the second most powerful nightmare. And yet in each case, it's kind of almost held within like scar tissue protectively. And the people then around, you know, don't know how to share it, don't know how to relate to it. They basically feel cut off from the people that they're close to who don't share one of the most profound experiences of their lives. And we see the same exact things repeated today with the veterans returning from combat abroad.
That's why I feel it is so important for our generation to start examining how we were shaped by our father's war, because mm-hmm. we have so much now that has played out that we can learn from. Our lives are a model, are a paradigm that we can use to mm-hmm. help the troops coming home now, to help their families, to say, hey, this is what's at stake. This, you know, we're not, you know, it's bad enough that just any veteran's life should be in any way disfigured by his war service. That's bad enough. But if, like, his entire family and their children will be disfigured, I mean, you know, we're talking about stuff that goes from generation to generation. And every generation in our country, in any country, has had a war. And what I'm beginning to see, you know, I started off this journey thinking this was a very personal story. And with every step of the way, I realized it was so much more than my story. It was so much more than the World War II generation story. This is the story of how war has disfigured our psyches over the millennium. And
mm-hmm.
how all of our depression, all of our woundedness, all of our melancholy and dysfunction of families, I believe it's not a radical statement to say, connects to the woundedness of war and trauma and atrocity.
I agree with you. I think having studied, and we had exchanged about this before you're coming on the show, as a practitioner of a healing form that's done in a group called Systemic Family Constellation Work, which really addresses the group psychology and the entire collective or community or family that is interrelated and undergoing healing together. It's a process for recovery. There are actually a whole range of different deaths, losses, traumas, exclusions, acts of harm of various kinds, just murdering your neighbor for his land or something like that, or poisoning the land, which is what I was speaking about earlier in our action today on gas drilling. But war is certainly a big one, and it affects a lot of people, and it's pretty major. And I think, you know, the idea that you just kind of go zip up the lip and shut the door, as you're pointing out, these things have ongoing historical systemic effects that we live in the reverberation of, and then, you know, suffer from and repeat. You know, it's interesting when you were talking about the Great Generation. I remember when that book came out and the lionizing and all of that, knowing what was going on behind the curtain, with my heroic, you know, soldier dad and actually my heroic soldier grandfather, who was in World War One. I was offended by the title, but, you know, part of this whole thing of putting a good face on everything so we can just kind of, to use a metaphor, soldier on, you know, keep marching forward and, you know, leaving that behind us. And you speak of that in your book, too, the sense that, you know, oh, we just shut the door on this and take a positive attitude and it's done somehow.
Right.
Is it?
Right. My father's mantra, he had a couple. One was keep the flag flying. The other one was always be strong, and the third one was we lift ourselves up by our bootstraps. You know, all that John Wayne ethos that generation really, I think, had no choice but to buy into. And one other thing I want to say about the going silent, I think there's such a cruel consequence of that, because as I talk now to veterans returning, they tell me, how can I not go silent? Because the last thing in the world I want to do is pollute my family with the horrible images and memories that I'm bringing home. And so soldiers feel like they have no choice but to lock that up. And I'm so grateful that all over the country right now, on a very grassroots level, writing workshops have been sprouting up to help veterans start processing and expressing and getting out of themselves this, you know, their memories, so they can start integrating them. And I know it sounds way too good to be true, but my life is a testimony that when we write our memories, the more we write them out, the more they actually become something else than within us. I mean, we literally get them out, get them on the page. They're not just our own. And so I think it's really important for people to know that as a healing strategy. But
I just want to say something about that, because we share this experience. I've been interested in trauma and trauma treatment and all of that in my own work with collective psychology for some time, and I just want to mention there are different schools of thought on that, and one of the things that they find is that what you're saying may, in fact, very well be true, probably is true for people like ourselves who are a subsequent generation. You know, we're the generation who can deal with it and embody it, and we may even see in our children the problem showing up in some form, so that will actually drive us to deal with it in some way. But the very first generation is so neurologically impacted that what they have found, and this was actually a fairly recent discovery, and I know this through the work of Bell Ruth Napersteck, who does a lot of work with using guided imagery for healing, is that the storytelling processing approach of psychotherapy that we know that can be helpful for so many things, like what you're describing, when someone is dealing with a triggered neurology, for example, due to a direct experience where they're having the nightmares, they're having the flashbacks, you know, it's basically taken over their nervous system and is programming trauma, it kind of is less helpful to tell the story and it needs to be dealt with in other ways. So this is a relatively recent discovery in psychology, and I highly recommend the work of Bell Ruth Napersteck, whose website is Healing Journeys, where there are a lot of resource tapes. So I just want to make sure that I'm not kind of, because up until 9/11, people, you know, the kind of given belief in psychotherapy has always been, you know, up until then, tell your stories. And it was found that with people who are direct trauma recipients, that can be triggering, actually.
Yeah, I think there's a difference, I think, between telling your story once or twice or three times and being in a very protected, safe, enclosed environment with a small, very small group that becomes your community, where you write these memories over and over and over again. I mean, that's the key component. And I'm not saying it's going to work for everybody, but I have met many, many, many veterans that it has worked for. Mm-hmm. And you know the danger with studies, for every study you read that says one thing, you can find another study that says something else. And I think, like with all of life, we have to approach people as individuals. And what might work for one person may not work for another, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think we always need to keep open. And I think that the key thing about healing trauma is that it has to be a very multifaceted approach, mm-hmm. that no one approach is going to ever be the answer for a person. Mm-hmm. But
what is your own background professionally that you bring to this?
My own background is, I'm not a psychologist or a therapist in any way. I went to graduate school in English after college, and then I went to law school. And then once I began realizing I had to deal with my father's photographs, on just a sort of subconscious level, one way I did that was by teaching a literature of the Holocaust course for 7 years at a Catholic university here in Austin. Mm-hmm. And then I spent 2 years traveling and meeting veterans. And since then, I'm now on an advisory task force here in Austin that's veterans, family members of veterans, the VA, trying mm-hmm. to create services that really meet the needs of the veterans. Mm-hmm. And I've created a website called Veterans Children where family members bring in their stories, both mm-hmm. those who have participated in war and those who have grown up as children of veterans, to help bridge the silence, to help create understanding of what was behind the silence, what was behind the alcoholism, what was behind the suicides. And it's been amazing to me to see mm-hmm. People suddenly understand their parent in a whole different way, which mm-hmm. leads to the compassion and the forgiveness, you know, which is the true source of healing. And getting back to what I was going to say earlier about veterans going silent about why it's so cruel, is that they do it out of desire to protect their families. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. I have learned, and I have seen so many in so many other families, silence does not protect, that children are amazingly perceptive and know that something's being withheld. And there's something about the human brain that a child blames themselves mm-hmm. for what's not being said, for what's not going right in the family. And if anything, then the silence transmits the trauma. It becomes the very potent agent for all of that fallout from the war becoming the child's legacy. And I have seen in so many people, children of World War II vets, children of Korean vets, Vietnam vets, this depression, constant talk of depression and estrangement in the family, never having been touched by their father. That's a key manifestation, that lack of physical intimacy in a family. And you just see the pattern over and over again. And that's why I think whatever means we can, we have to find to give veterans another option besides going silent.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you 1,000% on that. It's also as if also in that silence, it's contemplating that as you were saying it, because children are very sensitive with much more open antennae than, you know, most of us usually have by the time we grow into adulthood. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, they pick it up and absorb it whether it's spoken of or not. They pick it up, they carry it, they feel it. In some way, it's a setup for them to carry a portion of it. And
yes.
they do this out of
yes.
love to help their parent and help
right.
the whole family system. This is the view of the constellation work that I practice, to survive. And the thing is that when it's discussed on a conscious level, this allows the conscious part of the mind, you know, to kind of create a sort of helpful story or label for something, rather than, you know, having it just have this inner, unconscious, global, powerful impact without it even having a word or a name. And I think that is what is so hard, is it's carried by everyone, but without a name. And
oh, yeah. I mean,
the experience
I had growing up was that of being in a fog.
Mm-hmm.
Like feeling lost, feeling I couldn't even see what the forces were that were working on us. I knew something was very wrong, but I couldn't understand what it was. Mm-hmm. You know, and from the outside, everything looked good. The man at my father's office, the father I saw there, was a whole different person than the one he was at home, which I hear from so many people. And, you know, at the office, he was kind. He was a listener. He was physical with his patients. And I couldn't understand why didn't we have that at home. And I think that's what becomes really, really destructive for children, is to know that there's something going on. And what is it, you know? And are you crazy because you're the only one who seems to notice it,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm,
and one
mm-hmm.
example I have of that is one of the main manifestations of my father's trauma in my household was that my mother became the alcoholic, and like you talk about, you know, the systems approach of constellations therapy, a system, you know, every family is a system, as you all too well know, and so it's not always the veteran who manifests the woundedness.
Mm.
And so my mother was the one. She became an alcoholic. She probably had some depression or low-level bipolar. In combination with my father's trauma, just became untenable, and so she started drinking. And she drank so much, she ended up being taken away from me in a very, very traumatic moment for me. It was at a police station. She was screaming, "Don't leave me, don't let them take you, I'll never see you again." My father was in another room and hearing all of that. I was taken from her. I never saw her again. My father could not begin to talk about it, refused to even say the words, "your mother."
Mm.
Now, just one symptom of the veteran parent's inability to see what they're creating around them. My father would play records at dinner every night to substitute for conversation. And one of the records was the Yale Whiffenpoofs. Sounds pretty odd and funny, and in a way it was, but one of the songs was an African-American spiritual called "Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child."
Oh, my God.
Now, how could he play that song at dinner?
Oh, my.
He didn't do it out of cruelty. He was not a cruel man. He couldn't even begin to hear and see.
Mm.
And that's what happens with trauma, you know. And so knowing that I have been traumatized, I have worked very, very hard to gain that consciousness, to gain that awareness, to see what I'm doing, which is the essential first step to ending the legacy. You know?
I applaud that. We're going to go into a break here. And, you know, I completely agree. I mean, this is really doing the homework that we all have to do. So we'll be back discussing with Lila Levinson, the author of Gated Grief, Multigenerational Family Trauma, on Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and please stay with us.
To the Progressive Radio Network each day for the best progressive minds in the world.
Hey, Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry. PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one forum that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
Every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, join the founders of the Godspeed Institute for Spiritual Learning, Carol and Michael Hallenbeck, for Godspeed, an enlightening and informative journey into the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Through conversations with experts worldwide, this weekly live call-in program is an on-air classroom aimed at helping listeners gain exposure to and insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world. Every Sunday, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Mike Adams, the editor-in-chief and key writer of naturalnews.com and co-founder of the nonprofit site consumerwellness.org. I'll be starting a special segment on the Progressive Radio Network called The Health Ranger with Mike Adams. I'll be interviewing everyone from Dr. Jane Goodall to Suzanne Summers. Find out the latest in natural healing news and easy ways to live a healthier and more holistic lifestyle. So tune in on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern every week on the Progressive Radio Network to hear The Health Ranger with Mike Adams.
Listening to the number one internet radio station for progressive minds, the Progressive Radio Network.
Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and on today's show, I'm talking with Lila Levinson, the author of Gated Grief, an amazing book about her personal journey back to the truth of the family source of pain and disconnection with her father's traumatic experience as a soldier and doctor in World War II, in which he liberated, was one of the liberating army of one of the concentration camps. And actually, there are many, as we've been discussing, of the great generation who underwent this experience. And we've been talking about how the sorrow, the loss, the trauma, the disconnection of this, you know, unhealed wound basically continues and perpetuates itself down the generations until we turn around and face the grief and the sorrow and grieve together and integrate it. So we've been just having a wonderful subject, you know, show on this very important topic. I think it's something we could talk about, you know, for weeks and months. I just want to point listeners to Lila's websites. One is her name website, Lila. LilaLevinson.com, and Lila is spelled L-E-I-L-A, Levinson, L-E-V-I-N-S-O-N. And her other website is VeteransChildren.com, and that is also what makes this discussion so relevant today. It's not just about ancient history. The same family tragedies are being carried forward today as a new generation of military military members goes to war, experiences trauma in the field, and comes back home. You know, we were discussing that I have been a practitioner for over a dozen years of a form called family constellation work that actually comes out of Europe and Germany to address this as a sort of systemic collective form of psychology. The work is done in group. People who are interested in all of my health and environmental activist policy reporting can sign up at my health journalist blog website, and I do have a weekly e-zine that contains radio show links, activist links, and my Huffington Post blogs. But for those of you who are interested in this topic, I would like to point you to my other website, which is collectiverealm.com, and you can actually there get a download of an article about the constellation work. You know, one of the insights from the healing work of working on these issues in the constellation group format, Lila, is that really the family becomes the container for the wounded returning veteran, because they are, you know, the sort of the protective shelter, the encirclement in which that individual now lives at the center. And therefore, quite naturally, as you shared in your family history, the spouse, the children, they are all there containing the parent. In a healthy system, the parents contain the children. So, you know, here you have a reversal where instead of being contained and protective, the children are drafted into that role. And then they also have the experience, which you discussed was yours and that of many of the people you've talked to, where there's a kind of disconnect in that the wounded parent, the returning veteran, this traumatized individual, is not really available to the family members. He's sort of missing in action on a level of psychological and spiritual presence. And one of the things that we see in the constellation work, because we're working with the whole system and members of the family in each constellation are represented by workshop participants, so that we see not only, say, the father represented, but the mother and every member of the system and how they organize in this situation. That's what a constellation will reveal. We really can see the roles that different people play. And everyone in the family may take on a different role. You know, somebody may take on dad's grief. Someone else may represent the victims that he saw and lead a life of victimization. Someone else may represent the people he killed in war. Someone may represent his missing comrades. So, you know, there are a lot of people, you know, we kind of grew up in America, especially in that post-war era, thinking we're here in a little individual nuclear family. And it's just us in our family, and that's it. But actually, in our family, with these war contacts, there are a lot of other people that are not our blood relatives, but that really are the people with whom dad connected in war. You know, so, and they are there with us too as ghosts. And so one of the great virtues of the constellation work is that you can see that embodied. And actually, I remember the first time when I was just studying the work and did one of the very earliest constellations of my family. One of the things that happens is that you sort of position the different family members, the people who are representing them, kind of like carrying that person's role or standing in for them. I positioned them, and we all saw my father was facing completely away from our family members and had no apparent interest in us. And I remember I said to the facilitator, "What is he looking at?" He's not looking at us. He's looking away. The facilitator brought in the victims. That's who he was looking at. That's who he was with. He was disconnected with us. He was present with them. And because of that, being able to see who he was with and including who he was really the road to understanding and accepting the situation. So I just want to offer that insight, because from just inside the family, it looks like he's not here. But it's not that he's nowhere. He's somewhere. He's with someone. He's with these other people who touched him at such a deep level. So I'm just wondering, you know, if that resonates for you with anything that you, you know, kind of had encountered there.
Easily have been of a life of a Jewish person in Eastern Europe in 1941, 42, 43. I mean, the way I was separated from my mother in a police station, to her hysterical, you know, sobbing and pleading, the way my father put me on a train when I was six the next summer in Grand Central Station by myself to send me to a camp. And the train, it was an overnight train, and when I woke up in the morning, we were in the middle of a forest. You know, I mean, it's very strangely resonant of experiences of people during the Holocaust. And one thing I would like to say is Native Americans, as in so many ways, offer us tremendous wisdom. And there's a man in Albany, New York, Dr. Ed Tick, who has been working with the trauma of war for over 30 years. And I recommend to your audience a book he wrote called War and the Soul, which was of huge importance for me on my journey. And Ed was trying to figure out what is possible to help heal our veterans. And he turned to Native American tradition. And when warriors would come back from war, they were not returned to the tent with their family. They were sent out for many, many weeks with elder warriors to process and integrate their experience, because Native Americans knew and know that how the family will be poisoned until that warrior has a chance to, you know, shed those memories, but integrate them and normalize them and then become aware in their family again.
That's beautiful. That is just incredible.
And so we still have so much to learn about saving our environment, saving our souls from Native Americans. What you say about how people will play out roles in the family, there are other ways I could talk about, but I really don't want to right now, about how different members of my family took on different roles. And, you know, I never could understand why, when I would go to a movie about the Holocaust, I mean, Sophie's Choice, I couldn't leave the theater. I was so hysterical. I just could not stop sobbing. And I kept thinking, why? Why am I having this much pain come up, you know? And only years later did I connect the dots, as your program says.
And people, and it can actually create a situation in families too where people are at odds, because they're, you know, unconsciously carrying, you know, the emotional experience of unseen other participants in a way that can breed conflict that is otherwise kind of inexplicable, really. And, you know, and then the people who carry it, like, for example, one of the things that I observe in public life today, there is such a kind of harsh and cruel attitude expressed by some public officials when someone is in need, if they're elderly, if they're suffering, if they're ill, if they're frail, if they're having any kind of problem, rather than the sense that as a society or as a community, we kind of step forward to help and bring support, and the sooner the better, because that's really the way then to heal a system rather than have things building and worsening into, you know, ever escalating crises. Instead, there's this, you know, very inhumane, harsh attitude of cruelty. And that's one of the reasons I'm also interested in this topic, because I'm very frequently contemplating, where does this come from?
Yeah.
Why should such attitudes be viewed as acceptable?
Right.
Why should they even be in the pale?
People who profess to be Christians, where the fundamental message of Christianity is to help those in need, that, you know, to always extend love and charity to those, you know, not as well off as ourselves. And that seems to be a huge contradiction in this country that I too have never really been able to understand. But you're right, this might really be what underlies that.
You know, some kind of, pattern of cruelty that has not been faced up to. And, you know, wallpapering it over it and saying, you know, we're all one, either, you know, on the spiritual end of the spectrum, or let's just be nicey-nice and, you know, not focus on the negative. However you do it, it doesn't work that well to wallpaper over it, I think, is really... you know, as we were discussing earlier, there are different ways that people, different forms of health intervention that people might use to address this. You were talking about writing and journaling, which has been very well studied, actually, for letting go of a bunch of things. We talked about guided imagery, the constellation work, but certainly, you know, just kind of soldiering on.
Yeah, and I think just this morning, it's interesting we're talking about this now, because just this morning, a Facebook friend of mine who's the daughter of a Vietnam vet, and by the way, children of Vietnam vets have been much more aware of their legacy than children of World War II vets, I think because it's been clear from the get-go how messed up that war was and how messed up the participants were. But she is up at Fort Hood today, which is about an hour's drive north of Austin, where I live, because there's a huge protest by veterans and family members and other people towards the administration of Fort Hood, which is known for redeploying troops who are greatly suffering from trauma. I mean, think about that. You know, you're sending back somebody who's traumatized. I mean, what could be more cruel than that? There was an article in the Killeen newspaper about it, and some of the comments were just unbelievably hateful about how these people are faking it and how they signed up for this. You know, they're getting what they asked for, and it's what you're talking about exactly. You know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, so what it says to me, Lila, is that in a time where there's a rising tide of those kinds of harsh and punitive and uncaring values, and therefore, you know, more people may be drafted into that, or, you know, it's an expression of some of this unhealed grief, you know, taking this kind of form.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now is a time when we really need to talk more openly about some of these sort of hidden psychological patterns. You know, one of the things in the constellation work, and this is a completely separate and rather controversial issue, so perhaps this is a terrible idea to bring this up, but one of the things that is mentioned that is also a trauma to a family system are early deaths of children, whether by you know, illness, miscarriage, abortion, or whatever. If a very young child, you know, dies in the family, this is a tremendous grief wound into the family system, an unbearable loss. And many people do attest that it's one of the hardest losses, you know, for a parent or a sibling to accept, you know, to deal with. And so one frequently there also finds these kind of soldiering on responses because of all the unhealed grief. And, of course, these deaths occur. I mean, and they were even more common in earlier days. So, you know, there could be a lot of that going on in systems, for example, mm-hmm. which I've often hypothesized could be around a sort of backdrop, mm-hmm. a sort of psychological shadow backdrop
right,
to
part
the
of the
powerful
mm-hmm.
debate about, you know, abortion and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's like kind of look to, instead of sort of papering it over, look to the history, look to the shadows. Deepak Chopra has pointed to some research which also shows that these kinds of the level of trauma that we're talking about today is also the kind of thing that can produce epigenetic changes, you know, that can actually change
your genetic
gene expression. Yeah, exactly. And so and influence people's resilience and coping and, you know, a whole bunch of things like that.
And it's great that you brought that up because I think there's an important point I'd like to make here.
Mm-hmm.
I had a very difficult time. I remember the first time a therapist said to me, you know, you were traumatized by your childhood. And I couldn't run fast enough in the other direction. And I've observed that same response in many of the veterans I've spoken with and many of their children. And I wrestled for the longest time, what is that about? And I remember very clearly a moment when I was in the midst of the research for my book, and I came upon some research done by a Yale biologist, I believe his name is Charney, David Charney, and he was one of the first people to research how trauma changes your genes.
Mm.
And I remember just feeling sick to my stomach that I wanted to throw up and just clicked off the computer and couldn't sleep. And I'm like, okay, what is this about? And what I realized, which was a very difficult thing for me to acknowledge, that it is repulsive to accept our own disfigurement. Because we are all, Jews have a term, neshama Torah, pure soul. We are all born with a pure soul. And when you are traumatized, you lose that purity. You lose even that who you might have been. And you've lost that potentiality, and you can never have it back again. I mean, as much as we'd like to believe that we can heal trauma, yes, I do believe healing's possible, but it's a journey, and we never arrive at the destination. We will never be recovered. And that is an extremely difficult thing to accept. And I think that is something that really we need to start talking about. I think it's part of the reason that there's so much resistance to therapy, even more than the stigmatization of mental illness in this country, is who can accept that they have lost that potentiality? And it's not to say that we can't be something else. I mean, part of my journey was accepting, okay, you know, you can't change your history. That's a given. And as Viktor Frankl says, the important thing is, what are you going to now make of it? How can you turn this into a strength? How can you turn this into a blessing? And I think, again, we need to hold that out to people. We need to hold out the hope and the redemption that, okay, we are all very, very wounded. But instead of living subconscious victims or aggressors and playing all this out, let's start creating awareness so we can make it into our strengths and start healing the world.
Amen. That was just beautiful. We're going to have to wrap up our show pretty quickly here, but, you know, that was just incredible. You know, also, it's really interesting, too, what you're describing. I mean, what you shared, the view that, you know, that we can never be whole again. And yet, you know, the Eastern traditions would teach that in some level we're always whole. You know, and so I know that I could just hear right away that debate of cosmologies mm-hmm. kind of going on.
Yeah, I'm not saying that we can't be whole again. I'm mm-hmm. just saying we can't be who we might have been if that trauma hadn't happened to us. Do you know what I mean? And so, you know, there's that other concept in Judaism of tikkun olam, of healing the world,
yes.
repairing the broken vessel. And
right.
so I do believe that is possible, but we still will be something other than what we would have been. You know,
well,
so I think
you know, because of some of my studies of quantum physics and other things like that, it's kind of, I hold that a little bit differently because, you know, there are many, at all times, there are many different choices and almost like levels of reality that could or could not
right.
be manifested.
Right.
I don't think it's
chaos theory.
As deeply engraved for us to be able to say that absolutely certain.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that it is or that it isn't. Mm-hmm. So, but I hear you that this is your understanding of the Jewish spiritual cosmology, and I really honor that, and I hear the authenticity and the truth of it. So I'm not trying to kind of whitewash it. But I'm not. I just want to hold that I'm not sure that it's that indelible, and or even that the concept of who I might have been is. I mean, that's a reflex. I don't relate to that concept.
Right. Well, I mean, it's a longing. It's sort of like that longing for Eden, because you know you will never know, and human beings are by nature vulnerable to trauma. It doesn't take much to traumatize a person. Just, you know, witnessing a car accident is traumatic. But I guess, you know, it's interesting that the word wholeness in Hebrew, the word for it is shalom, which is the same word for peace. So I do believe that if we find a healing path ourselves and find a peace for ourselves,
vis-a-vis our family members, that peace for others. We're going to have to end our show here today, but it's been wonderful having you with us, Lila Levingston.
Thanks so much.
Book Gated Grief is wonderful.
I really have enjoyed our conversation, Alison.
And come back next week, listeners, Saturday at noon on Progressive Radio for Connect the Dots with Alison Rose Lee.